Matt O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. Massachusetts voters are being asked to decide on where they stand on a major education issue these days. People armed with initiative petitions are fanning out across the state seeking signatures. And the signatures will be used to back a law and perhaps a referendum that would end bilingual education as we know it in favor of all English classrooms or immersion. Now, California voters have ordered that, and Arizona has a similar law. But the process is not easy. Backers of the petition must get 57,100 qualified signatures by November 21st, November 26th in Boston. If that happens, the law can be certified on December 5th, and then the legislature has until next June to pass it. If they don't, and it seems likely that they will not, the backers then have 1 month to get another 9,517 signatures to get the referendum on the ballot. Then, and only then, the voters will decide in November of 2002. To help us deal with this controversial issue, we have representatives from two organizations. With me in the studio is Mary Casaubon, Director of Bilingual Programs, Kindergarten through 12th grade for the City of Cambridge. Welcome, Ms. Casaubon.
Thank you, Ted.
And on the phone line is Dr. Rosalie Porter, co-chair of the Bilingual Education Ballot Initiative, the one that would make those classrooms English only. Welcome, Dr. Porter.
I'm happy to be here.
All right. We've defined the people. Now let's begin with some other definitions. Let's start with you, Ms. Casaubon. What is bilingual education? How do you define it?
Bilingual education ought to be education that could serve all children. And that's really how we define it in Cambridge. We don't look at it as specialized programs only for language minority students. We've been working over the last several years at attempting to integrate and open up our bilingual programs for all our students so that children will have the benefit of learning from each other and also learning a second language from each other. And in this way, English homespeaking kids can share English with, let's say, Spanish speakers or Haitian Creole speakers or Mandarin speakers. And this is what we've been doing in Cambridge. And we think we've been quite successful at it. And although it's a process like education itself, that continues, and we need to look at how we can improve schools, and we do believe that by looking at our language minority students and their skills that they bring to the school as a resource is one way to do that.
Okay. Dr. Porter, how would you define bilingual education?
I would define it quite differently. I would give it the legal definition as it was defined in Massachusetts and as it was defined in federal legislation from 1968 on, and that is to meet the needs of children who come to school not knowing the common language of the classroom and the community, the English language. The aim of bilingual education from the beginning was, in the words of the law, to remove the language barrier to an equal education. And this is the prime concern of this legislation. It is to give children who are English learners the skills and tools to be able to take advantage of all the opportunities in the American education system. Now, over the years, bilingual education has expanded to much more than that, and that is the kind of program that Mary Casaubon is directing in Cambridge, which is very admirable, but it is only one kind of bilingual program. The main issue here is bilingual education requires that children be taught in their native language while they are learning English, that they be taught all their school subjects, and reading and writing first in the language they come to school with. Let's say Spanish, because that is the main language of two-thirds or more of bilingual children.
Okay.
And while they are learning English, they also will be keeping up through studying their other subjects in their native language.
I see.
It was meant to be a temporary transition program, which within a few years would help these children become competent in English and able to participate.
And what has it become in your view, Dr. Porter?
In my view and in my practical experience and in my research over the past 25 years, I have seen that in many instances, it delays the learning of the second language to the point where students are then behind and it's very hard for them to catch up.
Okay, Mary Casaubon, do you agree with that?
The kind of research that I have personally been involved with has been about our programs in Cambridge. And as Rosalie did indicate, we do depart from the typical TBE model. Personally, I believe that we ought to offer more for our students. And so at the elementary level, transitional bilingual education in Cambridge has really become integrated education. So if I'm to speak about bilingual ed, I would like in particular to talk about the benefits of integrated bilingual education. And because Rosalie did mention about our Latino students, I have looked at the MCAS scores of our eighth grade Latino students in Cambridge, those who were in our two-way bilingual program, that's our two-way language immersion program, and those students who were not necessarily in TBE, because I do not have a TBE program for eighth graders in Spanish, but for ESL only, for example, and also students who are Latino background but who are English proficient. And interestingly enough, what we have found is that the children who are receiving instruction in Spanish actually outperformed their Latino peers in the eighth grade consistently over the last 3 years of MCAS in Cambridge, and I'm just talking about the eighth graders in particular. So I think that we can see that there is great promise for bilingual education that does go beyond the confines of the transitional bilingual education law that Rosalie has defined.
How many students in Massachusetts participate in bilingual education? Dr. Porter?
Well, the state counts 49,000 students as coming to school with a limited knowledge of English. Whether every one of those students is in a bilingual program, I cannot say. I will say this, 70% of bilingual children are Spanish speakers, and this is the group for whom most bilingual programs are designed. I can say almost with a certainty that there are no or almost no true bilingual programs, let's say, in Chinese or Korean or Hebrew. For most other language groups, the kids are given help with the English language rather than native language instruction. So we're really looking at the majority of bilingual children who are Spanish speakers. And for this group, the performance in Massachusetts has not been very successful on the MCAS tests. And I did a piece of research 2 years ago that was published on MCAS and bilingual students. And in almost every measure and at almost every grade level, bilingual students scored at a lower level than all others. I will say the Cambridge program has produced very good results, which Mary can be proud of, and that's documented.
But you are saying that that the Cambridge experience is not duplicated across the state.
No, the Cambridge program, and I should really let Mary speak to this,
yes,
because the Cambridge program is the longest-running two-way program, one of the longest-running in the country. They have had a long time to make this a really good, functioning program. Mary, you have more to say about that.
Certainly, Rosalie. Always have more to talk about two-way bilingual education. But I'd also like to mention, because you did talk about Chinese and Korean, that we have begun in Cambridge integrated programs for our Mandarin-speaking children in Cambridge, as well as for our Korean students. And these programs differ from the transitional bilingual approach, and yet they're not quite a two-way approach either. The children are totally mainstreamed. But they are given English as a second language support, inclusion as much as possible into their mainstream classrooms. And the children do come out for 1 hour a day of native language support. And this is in the content area with language arts, humanities, and social studies. But it's only an hour a day. And on top of that, in one of our schools where we have our Nihao, which is our Mandarin program, where the children are mainstreamed, we also invite the mainstream children to learn Mandarin, just a little bit of time every day. It's a half an hour, but they're learning together.
Yes.
And we're up to seventh grade. Actually, we're up to fifth grade if we look at children who began in kindergarten. And we've been able to put together some statistics. And what is very nice is that we have a lovely linear growth pattern where we can see that the children who are learning Mandarin, and these are English-speaking kids, are really actually developing it. And this is quite an accomplishment, I think, for education of FLES, or foreign language in the elementary schools, that does not have a very good track record, in particular in the United States. So there's a lot of promise here, too. But not only are the children all learning Mandarin together, even though it's a half an hour a day, they're also really coming to know each other. And what we have found is that their friendships, the kinds of friendships the students are forming now, where the Mandarin-speaking children are mainstreamed except for that hour, is that they're really relying on each other and identifying each other as closest friend, preferred partner for math class.
That's excellent. Those are all wonderful things to accomplish. And one of the biggest problems with bilingual education as it was first formulated was the segregation, dividing kids by ethnic background and language for not only most of the school day, but for several years. So the Spanish speakers spent 5/6 of the school day with Spanish speakers. That is what I know that we agree, Mary, that this is not the way to go. I would just like to make the very important point that as it has been possible for Cambridge and a few other districts to diversify their bilingual programs, there has never been the flexibility in the Massachusetts law to allow a district that wanted to try an English immersion program to do so legally. And this is what has always bothered me a great deal. I'm an integrationist, too. I want to see bilingual children brought into the mainstream, making friends with English-speaking classmates, and being able to function at their own highest level, do their best academic work in English. Then, if we can also give them an enrichment program in Mandarin or in Italian or in Portuguese, that's wonderful, too.
Okay, would you propose, then, to change the bilingual law, not to prevent necessarily what Mary Casaubon is doing in Cambridge, but to make it ancillary to the immersion program? Is this what we're talking about here?
Yes, indeed. I don't, for a moment, want to forbid Cambridge to do the good program that Mary has designed. But for too long, we have not had the right to have any kind of an innovative program that proposed to teach the children English in a very intensive way and get them into the mainstream more quickly without using the native language.
What would be wrong with that, Mary? How would you see that as disrupting what you're doing?
Well, I'd like to answer that in two parts. One is that we do deal with this situation in Cambridge by giving parents an option for choice, so that even though we do have these bilingual programs, there will be parents who, for whatever reason, will prefer English immersion for their children.
But what does that mean, Mary? Does that mean an English immersion program or just being in the classroom with no extra help?
Well, what it would mean,
that's the key thing.
Right. Well, what it would mean for us in Cambridge, for those parents who really do not want bilingual education at all, for whatever reason, then their choice is to have a mainstream placement for their child with English as a second language, a support, a professional who would go into the classroom and work with that child for a portion of the day. And we do honor parent choice.
I know you do, Mary, but listen, you are doing something that is not allowed under Massachusetts law. And we have been told this many times, there is no provision in the law for giving extra help only in English. Parents have the right to have their children in a bilingual program or out. That has been explained to me so many times by the Department of Education under current law. And I don't fault you for doing what you're doing. I think it's great. But it is not legally allowable.
Right. Well, we're doing it because we do believe it's best. However, there is a bill that Representative Cabral and Barrios have submitted, which does allow for more freedom for schools.
Oh, I have to disagree with you, Mary. The Massachusetts State Bilingual Advisory Council spent all of last year reviewing Representative Barrios' bill that was to enhance or reform bilingual education. And what the council discovered is that the bill provided for three different types of programs. Each one of them requires at least 20% native language instruction every day. It does not allow the kind of flexibility that I'm talking about. The flexibility to have either an English program, a transitional bilingual program, or a two-way program, that is not in his bill. And therefore, the state council said, we will not support this bill. We will give you an alternative. We drafted an alternative bill and sent it to Representative Barrios' office. We never heard a word back. It was never acknowledged. Our recommendations as educators in this field were completely ignored.
Okay, at this point, I just want to tell everybody you're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Our guests are Dr. Rosalie Porter, who's co-chair of the Bilingual Education Ballot Initiative, and Mary Casaubon, who's director of bilingual programs K through 12 for the city of Cambridge. Let's step back for a moment. I want to ask both of you, what do the students think about bilingual education? Has anybody checked with them, and do they think it works?
I have. I just completed my dissertation, so
going to have to call your doctor next week.
No, yes, I am doctor.
All right, congratulations.
In December, right? And I have looked at students' opinions about their education, their bilingual education, and I have to, you know, I have to say that the kids have an awful lot to tell us, and usually it's very compelling. They know when something's working, when something's not, and they're really good at giving advice. And in particular, the students that responded to my interviews wanted to point out that bilingual education, if done right, can have an incredible impact on a student's life, and it did on their lives. And they gave many instances about how it truly
could you give
improved
us specifics,
them.
Two or three?
Yes, I'm going to talk about a student who is an English speaking, native speaking student who said that her experience being in a bilingual program changed the way she viewed others. And what she meant by that is that she came to understand that students who were racially and linguistically different from herself and her family could do just as well on exams, perform just as well in regular schoolwork, and that, in fact, they could be her true friends. And that she has promised that as she goes through school, she is going to give back to the community, and her community now is defined as being an extended community embracing language minority as well as language majority folks.
Dr. Porter?
Well, I think that is just wonderful, and in fact, this is what we want for our children. We want them to appreciate each other's cultures and languages. My experience, I have not done research in a classroom, but I have reviewed and published research studies from Miami-Dade in Florida public schools, from El Paso, Texas, where we started an English immersion program and compared it with a bilingual program. And among the things that were looked at were not just academic performance, but how the students felt about their program, how they were enjoying school, how they liked what they were doing, their self-esteem. At the end of 3 years of each of these programs, and at the end of 5 years, the students who had been in English immersion programs had as high a sense of self-esteem as the kids who had been in bilingual programs. There are very, very good things accomplished by any good program. I don't care what the design is. We have seen some bilingual educators predicted that if children were put into English immersion, they would have a negative feeling about themselves. They would, you know, that has not come through in the research literature.
All right, so we have two different views of student response as well. Let me ask about California. We know that there are political ramifications to every decision that are made in this area. A private citizen got a ballot initiative in California. According to what I've read, since immersion has been mandated by the voters, the scores have improved for the kids that started out as Spanish speakers. Am I accurate, Dr. Porter, Dr. Casaban?
I've had a lot of involvement with the California initiative. I helped write the original initiative language. I've testified in court when it was challenged in court. I've testified on behalf of the state of California. And I have looked at the research of the past 3 years. Now, again, bilingual educators in California predicted that these children would fail miserably if they were forced to be in English immersion programs.
Right.
That has not been the case. Now, it is true, California has done some other things at the same time. They have put more teachers into the classroom. They have changed the reading programs. They have reduced the teacher-student ratio. But it is a fact that in the districts that have implemented an English immersion program right from the beginning, those students are showing greater academic success in English than the schools that have retained their bilingual programs. And I think this is a very important piece of evidence.
Dr. Casaban, a comment.
Right. Well, I often worried about several of my friends and my older daughter's friends who went out to California to teach, and some actually taught in bilingual programs. And I had conversations with them, and from what they described their programs, they seemed not to be very well implemented. There was a lot of disarray, disorganization, and all I can say is from what I have heard personally from individuals who have taught out there in TBE programs, that I don't believe those programs were well implemented. And I think first and foremost, we have to have good education for children. That's more important than anything. We have to have a strong commitment that children are going to learn. And I do believe, however, that if that commitment is there, we can certainly teach children in two languages.
Okay, let's go on to how you measure success. Recent study of the Massachusetts bilingual ed programs by the Lexington Institute found some serious flaws in the program. Students weren't improving their command of either English or their second language, and nobody at the state level was monitoring progress. What's going on here?
Well, the Lexington study, I just had a chance to read it over today. It is really a study not of the whole state or all of the programs, but of the cities that won federal grants to do a particular thing to improve the education of bilingual children. And it seems that in many cases, what these people were given money to do didn't get done. That's the plainest way that I can characterize it. The other part of your question, Ted, had to do with the state of Massachusetts collecting data and then never publishing it. Over the past, certainly, 15 or 20 years, the state has collected information about bilingual programs, how they're organized, and some test data on how children were learning English. For whatever reason, the state of Massachusetts has never produced a research study or a report on the academic progress of bilingual children until MCAS came along. Now we are seeing some real data on how bilingual children are progressing.
And in general, what in general, Dr. Porter, what is that data showing? In general
that
now.
That data is not showing great results for bilingual children, even though they are excused from state testing until they are in their fourth year in Massachusetts schools.
Dr. Casaubon, is that your understanding of the larger picture?
Well, I do agree with Rosalie in her assessment that the state has been perhaps remiss in not using any of the multiple data that we send in every year through our yearly reports. I do believe that this data would be very important and very compelling. For example, one of the assessments that is mandated would be the language assessment scales in reading and writing. This is an assessment that all students in bilingual education programs in grades 2 through 8 must take after they've completed 2 years in the program. And in Cambridge, we do our own statistics and we analyze our scores because we need to have that kind of information to improve our programs. And just last night, I was working on a document and found that for our elementary programs, all combined, 70% of the students reach the competency level in the last R&W, which would be the top level. And I think this is really important, and I agree with Rosalie. I would have liked the state to have done more or still could do more because we're still turning in those end-of-the-year reports. Mm-hmm. As far as the Lexington study, I've also read it, and I think that there was a lot taken out of context. I can't speak, of course, for other programs that did receive money, but I can speak for Cambridge. Our grant was for system-wide reform, and in fact, we really have done system-wide reform. One of the areas where they pointed out that there is a gap between our Latino students and our English native speaking students on an assessment where they never reach within 10 percentage points of the scores. However, I really don't think that's the issue. The issue is that we have sustained progress and that children are reaching competency. And even in the California studies that have been done from the past 3 years, the gap between native English speakers and English language learners is much greater even now than 10%. It runs anywhere from 35% all the way up to 49%. And never goes below 35. This is in grades 2 through 8.
I'm Ted O'Brien. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. Our guests are Dr. Rosalie Porter, co-chair of the Bilingual Education Ballot Initiative, and Dr. Mary Casaubon, director of bilingual programs K through 12 for the city of Cambridge. Dr. Porter, you conducted your own study of Bay State bilingual ed programs. What did you learn? What do you conclude from that makes you want to chair this ballot initiative?
Well, It's very discouraging after being in the state that passed the first bilingual education law in the country in 1971, a law that I believed was necessary, and I became a bilingual teacher because of that original law and because I wanted to help immigrant children have a better education. And after spending 25 years in this state, seeing that until the past couple of years, we had no research data collected and published to show that all of the effort we have put into bilingual education was having any results, good or bad. The evidence wasn't there. Now we have the MCAS, and when we did our MCAS study on bilingual students, we only had the first 2 years data, but it was very discouraging. And I will say that until this year, I have spent 15 years advocating for bilingual law reform. I've gone to the State House. Mm-hmm. I've helped legislators with information. And yet, legislators have never, never really taken the reins and made the changes that would have, I believe, made improvements in the education of these children. And this is why now I believe the only way to make the reform that's necessary and bring change is to have a ballot initiative and ask the people of Massachusetts to vote on it.
And the MCAS information, do you read it the way that Dr. Porter reads it, Dr. Casabon?
Well, I have looked at the MCAS results statewide, and they're pretty dismal in general. So I don't think it's too surprising that our English language learners do not fare well on the exam. In fact, Rosalie and I have even discussed the kinds of accommodations that really need to be made, especially for 10th graders. And in particular, my worry is about those students who do come in high school without formal schooling in their native country. And for these children, an MCAS in 10th grade, if let's say they came in 8th grade and they'd be eligible, right, for the 10th grade exam, where they have had to acquire literacy and content knowledge that's quite cumulative because, of course, it's based on the Massachusetts curricular frameworks, is almost an impossibility. And so this is what we're discussing, and I think we're both worried, right, Rosalie, about
yes.
these children.
Okay. Yes. At this point, I just want to say some critics charge that school administrators are afraid to dismantle or change bilingual programs because it means jobs, it means a loss of funding, it means, in a sense, admitting what you just told us you admitted, Dr. Porter. You put 25 years of your life into something that now really disappoints you.
Well, I think I would answer that with two comments, Ted. I think some bilingual educators do fear just that. And I think the fears have been fanned unreasonably because I have seen in other states, when the law has changed, bilingual teachers were not let go. Bilingual teachers have been retrained to teach in English immersion programs. I have seen this happen in California, in Texas, in Seattle, Washington, in Pennsylvania, where I have helped school districts redesign their programs. So it's an irrational fear. I do think people are always nervous about change. But, you know, with the best of all possible goodwill, it's still hard to change any bureaucracy, whether it's special education or bilingual education or vocational education. People do get proprietary about what they're doing. But I also want you to know, Ted, that there are thousands of teachers out there who have been disillusioned with bilingual programs, try as they might. Many of them of Latino background, but they have not been willing to speak out because it is such a politicized endeavor. And this, I know Mary and I agree about this, it should not be politicized. We should only be looking at what's going to work best for children.
I want to give you a chance to respond, Dr. Casabon, to that, because you don't strike me as afraid of much of anything.
Well, I think change is an interesting concept. In many ways, it's revolutionary because we have to sometimes do things that we haven't done before. And over the past several years, as we have been really changing our transitional bilingual education programs into these other kinds of programs, our teachers have been retrained. They have had to think in new ways. They've had to become more inclusive about the students that they would teach. And I think everyone actually benefited from that. We're certainly we didn't go out and do mass firings. In fact, teachers themselves feel a lot better about what they're doing now than perhaps before.
Well, I want to thank both of you, Dr. Rosalie Porter, Dr. Mary Casabon, for participating in this discussion of bilingual education. I'm Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas.
Thank you so much for allowing us to share our thoughts with
yes.
you.
Thank you, Ted. Thank you, Rosalie.
In Spain, they say, see, see. In France, you'll hear, oui, oui. Every little Dutch girl says, ya, ya. Every little Danish doll says, da. But, sweetheart, tell me why. No
won't listen to my plea, won't say yes in any language to me. When will you say, see, see? Here's a little knowledge, quite good. Maybe it won't help you, but it should. You can't go place unless you've learned how Latin say yes. That educational, inspirational, most sensational, yes.
I'm Ted O'Brien. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. We now turn to a friend of long standing, an on-air colleague and partner on the former Ted and Janet show on WRKO, Janet Jigalian. Janet subsequently ran for both Congress and the United States Senate and is currently Director of Physical Therapy for the Stone Institute in Newton. Janet Jigalian, it's great to see you again.
It's always great to see you, Ted.
I asked you to come here today not only to renew our acquaintance and our friendship, but also because, having worked with you over the years, I know something about your story as regards learning English and the circumstances under which you as a kindergartner or first grader first became acquainted with English. Could you go back to that and tell me what it was like growing up in the Tevakalian household?
Well, first of all, it was not just my home that was where Armenian was spoken exclusively, but the entire neighborhood was comprised of Armenian people as well, many relatives. And in the neighborhood, the stores were run by Armenians as well. So there was very little opportunity to even hear English spoken. And all my friends were speaking Armenian or were a part of the family or extended family. So when it came time for me to begin school, it wasn't just a problem that I had, but all my friends as well. We went to a school in Watertown, and the teachers were shocked that we were unable to speak any English or to understand any. And it was a problem for them more than a problem for us. My mother, I recall, went to school with me for a few days and sat beside me and just gave me some direction. She understood English. She was born in this country, but she spoke exclusively Armenian to me at home. And my father was from Armenia, and so he that's all he spoke, although he was in business and could speak English as well. So it was not a problem of their not understanding the language. However, with a little bit of direction from my mother for a few days as to what time I had to be somewhere or where the facilities were, how to get out of the building, the fact that we had to go home for lunch and come back in the afternoon, it didn't take very long. In fact, within 3 months, my mother said I was speaking fluently and understanding English well, as were almost all my friends as well. And we continued to speak Armenian together as a family and in the streets as well until we became, our families began to feel more secure within Massachusetts and the greater Boston area. My father's business took us out of Watertown, as many families then began to move out as well as they became a little more secure with their ability to function within the American English-speaking culture. And so we moved into Newton at that point. But there was never a problem as far as being able to understand or even, you know, dialects or catching on to anything that was being said to me as a youngster. So it was not a problem. And I really have believed, as the whole issue of bilingual education has been discussed and debated, and I recall way back when how we debated this issue, because it's one that's been an emotional one for many and one that is probably never going to be resolved to the needs or the satisfaction of diverse groups of people.
I'm curious, though, if you continued to speak Armenian at home and in the stores and with your friends, how did you pick up English just going to school for, what, 6 hours a day?
That's a long time when you really stop and think of it. And then you begin speaking some English with your friends, and you develop friends outside of your, you know, the street on which you live. So you begin to speak English, and you share time with them as well. And you start listening to the radio, and you hear the language spoken. And, you know, this was a way of growing, and it was certainly encouraged. And I was fascinated by learning another language. It was, I remember bringing books home, grammar books and conjugating verbs and just learning how to be able to communicate in another way. It was really fascinating.
And you were, what, about six when this?
Yes, yes.
6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And did you feel that your own culture was being put down by their insistence on speaking another language?
No, not really. Not at all. I mean, I realized as I got older, certainly, that this was the language of the country that I was living in, and I had to become fluent and confident of my ability to participate in what's going on. And this was never an issue, never. And my husband, however, also grew up in Watertown, as most Armenians back then did. He spoke Armenian within the family for a lot longer period of time than I, and I'm not 100% sure why, except that he didn't move from Watertown at a young age until he was in high school. And I think as a result, there are some phonics that, or some words that he has difficulty pronouncing. And I think that goes back to the fact that he was, that this was his primary language, and he still has difficulty trying to make the statement, the TH sounds, for example, or the D sounds. It's more difficult. But that happens, I think, with a lot of people who grow up speaking another language for a longer period of time and then transition.
So you think that the transition for you coming at 6 and then 7 and 8 made it a lot easier for you than
absolutely.
For your husband when it might have been 15 or 16 mm-hmm. when he made the full transition. Mm-hmm. We should point out, by the way, that I happen to know this, that your husband went on to a highly successful career.
Oh, absolutely.
Dealing in
with
words.
With the public.
Yeah, dealing in words.
Absolutely.
That's what he did.
That's
first
right.
as a writer in New York and mm-hmm. then with one of the major companies here in
That's
Boston.
Right.
And so,
and to this day, he's still doing a lot of writing. And so, I mean, it's never been a problem.
Consulting and all the rest of mm-hmm. it. And you are among the most articulate of talk show hosts. And,
aren't you
and
nice
in
to
general,
say.
Well, I know. I sat across from you for 6 years and got to know that very well. You mentioned that you had, in anticipation of coming here today, a big debate.
At work.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
At the Stone Institute. Could
That's
you tell
right.
me about that?
Well, we had a lot of patients who were in the rehab clinic at the time, and we were discussing this, and in comes our speech therapist, and she was very much opposed to eliminating any kind of bilingual program. She felt the value was so vast and so great. And I argued from the point that I felt that it almost retarded the student's ability to learn in both languages, perhaps, because they are not participating in the mainstream education that was being provided. And therefore, they'd have to learn in another way, but also learn the culture of why this is being taught this way. And I just felt as though it was a way in which a person may end up learning something, but not as much as they could had they been immersed into the educational mainstream program and then allowed to learn the language at the same time. Whether it was programs after school where a person is given a little more help in learning the language. When you stop and think of how the people who came here during the 30s, 40s that came to this country, who none of them spoke any English, and certainly, as was my experience, they grouped together because they felt security with one another speaking the language, but they all went to they went to school at night. Many of the adults went to English speaking schools and learned slowly, sure, but they learned eventually and all got jobs because this was the only way they were going to be able to be economically stable and sound and see growth within the family. So they had to reach out, and I don't see why that can't be done now. Why there can't be opportunities for afternoon school programs for people, young people to stay if they're having difficulty with the language, give them some additional help, whatever tutorial help they need in their language to allow them to understand what's happening if there are things that are not easy for them. And certainly, as my mother stayed with me for a short period of time, perhaps there could be some kind of guidance for those people who are certainly in the elementary years. I think that's where immersion works the best, in the early years. And so they need less of this daily guidance as to where they go, what they should do. However, in the senior, junior, and senior high school years, perhaps there's a need of a little more guidance because actually the expectations of them are greater also, so that they may need a little bit more help. But I'm sure there is a way of sort of honing or rehoning this program and making it tailor-made to meet the needs of today's society and make certain that people who are going through public education are getting a good education, one that is going to allow them to get the best secondary education and then go on to do even greater things.
Well, what was your story? I mean, here you walked into first grade speaking only Armenian. You said you were fluent within 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
How were your academics?
Fine. Fine. No, no problem.
Well, they were better than fine. Come on, tell me.
No, I did very well, yes.
Yes,
I
you did.
Very well.
And you went on to Boston University.
Yes, indeed.
And graduated.
For two different degrees from Boston University, as my husband did as well.
Mm-hmm. And then on to New York University mm-hmm. for advanced degrees.
That's
so,
right.
So having found this new culture, you took to it like a duck to water.
Let me also tell you about this young man that I've met in my choir at church. He is a second-year student at Harvard Medical School. He is from Philadelphia, and he did not speak any Armenian at all. He joined the choir last year. And he was anxious to become a little more familiar with what's happening in the Armenian community, so he wanted to learn to read and write, and he'd heard about this immersion program in Armenia. And he went there this summer, not even being familiar with understanding the language. Many people who don't speak it in Armenian households understand a lot of it, so they don't speak, but they understand. This was not his scenario. However, he went and spent 3 months in Armenia, and for 3 hours in the morning, they had like the didactic type of approach, and then in the afternoons, they had laboratories. And then in the evening, they were allowed to go out into the streets of the city and converse, and no English was to be spoken whatsoever. And he came back in September, and I can't begin to tell you the beautiful Armenian that he speaks and that he reads and writes. So if it can be done at an older age, if you want to do something, you know, I've always believed that, your desire has got to be there to make it work. And it was certainly in his case, and it's been very successful.
One of the arguments for bilingual education is to preserve the child's sense of himself, sense of his own personal worth. And you say that did not operate at all. You felt nothing negative.
I don't recall. Of course, it's a while ago, Ted.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't recall ever having felt put down or put upon or felt as though I was different from anyone else. I really don't recall that whatsoever. And perhaps that was largely because I was not alone in this kind of situation. Had I been by myself in a foreign country having to do it, it might have been different. But I think many, many situations are here in this country. We have many people speaking the same languages, and so they would not be alone. They'd still be sharing the same experience.
What were the long-term effects on your friends? You had a wide circle of friends, and I know you well. I assume you kept in touch with them.
Of course. Many of them are relatives, so I certainly have kept in touch with them. And they've all been very, very successful. And I'm sure that this is never going to be a hindrance in any way for them or one that will be a problem as they age either, because sometimes as you get much older, you know, and you develop kind of neurological problems and some senility or dementia, they say you get throwbacks to your primary language. And I don't know of anyone who has had any problems in that regard either.
Janet, I know you also as a very successful communicator and broadcaster. You were elected to public office in Westwood, your hometown. You went on to an outstanding career in the media.
I also ran for lieutenant governor, incidentally, if you recall.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. In between. It's a problem being a Republican in a Democratic state. But
you're
that's
right.
Neither
you're
here nor there.
It's a topic for another
on.
Night.
Topic for another time. But do you think that at any point along the way, consciously or unconsciously, because of this change of language, you might have been more interested in the media, in articulation, in public speaking, in vocabulary than under other circumstances?
That's a good question, and I'm really not sure I can answer it. Although for me personally, I have always been fascinated by words. I've been fascinated by the spoken word as well as the singing as well. And I know at one point I was very aware of accents. And I think many of us who grew up in the greater Boston area developed a Boston kind of accent. And I didn't like the sound of the real broad A and many of the sounds of words that I was speaking at that time. And so I made a conscious effort to try to neutralize the sound of it and make it like a nondescript sound. And I think I've been successful at that.
You've been successful at a lot of things. Of course, your fantasy and your dream was to be a torch singer.
How did you know? Oh, dear. Okay.
And then you came within an inch
of getting
of being,
there. Oh,
of,
sure.
Of being a torch singer. And then there was, of course, your medical career, which was diverted into physical therapy for mm-hmm. cultural reasons, really.
Well, that's another long story. However, certainly families had had a way of looking at the future for many of their children. And at that time, you know, going to college for girls was not all that important. But my parents allowed me to go, and I was ever so grateful, and it opened up many opportunities for me, certainly. And I wanted to be a doctor at one point, and Daddy felt that I would never marry an Armenian if I were to go on and become a physician. But that was the attitude then. Now it's a whole different ballgame.
It's a whole different ballgame, and one of your special qualities is that you can see how things operate in a particular time. And your largeness of heart will not permit hold a grudge.
It was probably the best decision my father ever made, because I would not have experienced all the other wonderful things that I've been fortunate enough to encounter.
All right. Well, we've wandered a bit from our subject at
hand. Absolutely.
But when they do come around with the petition for the referendum, which would call for all English classrooms, would you sign such a petition?
I would. And getting back to the discussion that we had at work today, I think that a lot of people there, especially all that they're beginning to see now with what's happening with the world and the fact that, perhaps English is a very valuable communication for us. And if we are unable to speak with one another within our own country, it may become a serious problem for us. And at one time, I know I argued against English being the national language of this country, but I've rethought that, and I've come to change my mind on that as well.
Janet Degalian, thank you for an honest and very warm presentation today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks to Dr. Mary Casaubon and Dr. Rosalie Porter, and a special thank you to Janet Degalian. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. Join the conversation at buwi.org. Our webmaster is Angel Cazelli. Tonight's program was produced by Jake Zuckerman and Chris Bannon. I'm Ted O'Brien. Good evening.
This is WBUR Boston.